We've all had that lecture from an uncle at a family barbecue, haven't we?
Oh, absolutely. The classic unsolicited financial advice.
Right. The one where he pulls you aside, claps you on the shoulder, and says, you know, the secret to wealth is simple. Just buy a house the absolute second you graduate. And I mean, that was fantastic advice for what, 1995?
Yeah, 1995, maybe early 2000s.
Exactly. But for anyone listening right now who is staring down the barrel of the 2025 cost of living crisis, that advice feels well, it feels less like a helpful financial tip and more like a cruel joke.
I mean, it really does.
Because when you compare an entry-level salary today against the down payment required for even a modest property, the gap doesn't just look wide, it looks mathematically impossible.
It is a profound frustration for an entire generation. I mean, you are basically being told to play a game where the entry fee has skyrocketed, but your starting chips haven't changed at all.
Right. The math just doesn't math anymore.
Exactly. However, this intense economic pressure is it's actually forcing a massive systemic shift in investor behavior. It is pushing people to completely tear up the old playbook and get incredibly creative with how they actually source their funds.
Well, today we're tearing up that old playbook together. This is a deep dive into the Strategic Capital Raising for Global Property Investment Guide. We are looking at how modern investors are acquiring property, you know, tapping into that legendary stability, passive income, and capital growth without actually draining their own bank accounts.
Which is the dream, right?
It is the dream. We're going to explore the modern mechanics of funding, from someone buying their very first rental unit all the way up to seasoned players expanding massive global portfolios. Okay, let's unpack this. How do we actually bridge this massive gap between the reality of our current bank balances and the capital required to build wealth through real estate?
Well, the very first step is a complete psychological reframe of what raising capital actually is. Because if you picture raising capital as just walking into a bank with your hat in your hand, you know, begging for a loan, you've already lost.
Oh, interesting. So it's not about being desperate.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Strategic capital raising is entirely about risk mitigation. It's a mechanism to limit your personal financial exposure while simultaneously allowing your portfolio to scale at a speed that would be, frankly, impossible if you were solely relying on your own savings rate.
So it's not a sign of financial weakness to use other people's money. It's the actual strategy.
Yes, exactly.
But before we get into the wild modern marketplaces where this money lives, I feel like we need to establish the baseline because money isn't just money. When you take someone else's funds, you are trading something specific in return. And fundamentally, every single type of funding boils down to two distinct categories, right? Debt and equity.
Yeah. Those are the twin engines of real estate finance.
Yeah.
And understanding the mechanics of both is absolutely non-negotiable.
Okay, lay it on me. Let's start with debt.
Let's start with debt. So at its core, debt is simply borrowed capital that comes with a legal obligation for repayment, plus a rental fee for the privilege of holding that money.
Which we call interest.
Right. Interest. This is your standard mortgage, a commercial bank loan, or even a promissory note from a private lender.
I always like to visualize debt as renting a heavy-duty piece of equipment, like, I don't know, an excavator from a hardware store.
Yeah.
You pay a fee to use someone else's very expensive tool, but once you finish digging the foundation, you return the tool.
That's a great way to look at it.
Yeah, and you don't owe the hardware store a percentage of the house you built. You own the final product completely. You get to keep the property, the rental income, and all the appreciation over time.
That analogy highlights the primary advantage of debt perfectly, which is absolute control. The bank doesn't get to tell you what color to paint the front door.
Right. They don't care about the landscaping.
Exactly. And they certainly don't get a cut when you sell the property for a massive profit 10 years later. But the trade-off is strict liability. You owe that monthly payment, whether you have a tenant paying rent or whether the property sits vacant for 6 months.
Yeah, the bank always gets paid.
Always. Equity, on the other hand, operates on a completely different mechanical level. With equity, you are exchanging a percentage of ownership in the property or a direct share of the future profits in return for upfront capital.
Okay, so if debt is renting the excavator, equity is more like building a house with a roommate. Like they pay for the bricks and the lumber, but in exchange, they get to live in the spare bedroom.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And because they live there, they get a vote on the paint colors, they have a say in how the property is managed, and crucially, they get a proportional payout when the house is eventually sold.
That shared dynamic is exactly how equity functions. You are bringing partners into the fold. The immediate benefit is that if the boiler explodes or the roof caves in, you aren't shouldering that financial burden alone. Your equity partners absorb the hit with you.
Which sounds nice for sleeping at night.
It is, but you are permanently capping your own upside.
Right, which brings me to a big question. Wait, if I have a great property deal lined up, why on earth would I willingly give up a percentage of my future profits to an equity partner? I mean, why not just get a bank loan, take the risk myself, and keep 100% of the upside?
That is the classic beginner question. And the answer is borrowing capacity and velocity.
Okay, how so?
Well, even if you have a spectacular credit score, a bank will eventually cut you off. They look at your debt-to-income ratio and say, sorry, you are over-leveraged.
They hit the brakes.
Right. If you rely strictly on debt, you might be able to buy one property every 5 years as you slowly pay down the principal.
Mm.
But if you bring in equity partners, you aren't constrained by your personal credit limit. You can fund three properties simultaneously.
Oh, wow. So it's about speed.
Speed and scale.
Yeah.
Highly experienced investors rarely operate in binary terms anyway. They engineer what's called a capital stack.
A capital stack.
Yeah. So they might bring in an equity partner to fund the 20% down payment.
Yeah.
And then secure traditional bank debt for the remaining 80%.
So they blend the roommate and the rented tool.
Precisely.
That completely changes how you look at a property purchase. It also means, I guess, that you have to do some serious self-reflection before you make a move. You have to figure out your own psychological boundaries. Are you someone who absolutely needs total control? Or can you handle the friction of, you know, collaborative decision making?
It really is a fundamental personality test. If you are a brand new investor, layering complex equity structures over institutional debt is just, it's a recipe for a massive migraine.
Yeah, keep it simple.
Right. A single funding option, like a straightforward mortgage, has fewer moving parts. But if you have the time, the risk tolerance, and the managerial skills, tapping into those blended structures unlocks exponential growth.
Which brings us to the actual marketplace. If you know your risk profile, where do you actually go to get this capital? Because we're looking at a global menu of money today, ranging from the dusty old school institutions to some genuinely revolutionary tech. I suppose the most obvious starting point is the traditional bank.
Yes, the traditional bank mortgage. It's heavily regulated and entirely standardized. The bank basically runs an algorithm on your financial life.
The dreaded algorithm.
Yeah. They want to see consistent income, pristine credit history, and a solid deposit. If you fit their neat little box, they offer you capital at a relatively low interest rate. It is highly effective for stable, straightforward rental properties.
But what if you don't fit into that neat little box? I mean, what if you are self-employed or you want to buy a dilapidated property that a traditional bank deems uninhabitable and they just refuse to lend against it? That forces you into the realm of private investors and partnerships, right?
Yeah, it does. And within that private realm, there is a strict dividing line between a silent partner and a joint venture. This dictates the entire power dynamic of the deal.
Okay, break that down for us.
Sure. So a silent partner provides pure financial utility. They wire the funds. They review the quarterly financial statements. But they have zero operational involvement. They do not want you calling them on a Tuesday to discuss plumbing quotes.
They just want the return. Whereas a joint venture, that's more of a marriage. You are splitting the labor. Like maybe I find the dilapidated property and manage the construction crews while my joint venture partner provides the cash and handles the legal permitting. You share the risk, the labor, and the reward equally.
Precisely. But finding high net worth individuals willing to partner on a joint venture requires a massive personal network. Historically, if you didn't have a rich uncle or belonged to the right country club, you were kind of locked out. What's fascinating here is how technology has fundamentally dismantled that barrier.
Oh, you're talking about real estate crowdfunding platforms.
Yes. Crowdfunding takes the concept of a massive institutional investment and fractures it into thousands of accessible pieces.
Like Kickstarter, but for apartment buildings.
Exactly. Instead of finding one millionaire to write a check for $100,000, a platform pools together 1,000 regular people who each invest $100.
It's democratizing the asset class, which is amazing, but I mean, I imagine there is a catch. The platforms hosting these crowdfunding campaigns aren't running charities.
Oh, they absolutely are not. The convenience of technology comes with a steep fee structure. The platforms charge management fees, setup fees, and they often take a percentage of the final profits.
It's like paying a toll to drive on a private highway. Sure, you bypass the traffic of the traditional banking system and you reach your investment destination much faster, but you have significantly less gas money in your tank when you arrive. Those fees compound over time and can severely eat into your actual returns.
Which is why some investors try to cut out the middleman entirely through alternative finance, specifically peer-to-peer or PTP lending. This connects borrowers directly with individual lenders online, totally bypassing both the banks and the heavy fees of traditional crowdfunding platforms.
But the absolute bleeding edge of all this alternative finance is tokenization and digital assets. And I have to push back on this a bit.
Okay, let's hear it.
The entire historical appeal of real estate is that it is tangible. I can touch the brick. I can stand on the dirt. Isn't introducing blockchain tokens just injecting high-tech crypto-style market volatility into an asset class that is valued specifically because it's boring and stable?
Your skepticism is entirely justified there. The mechanism of tokenization is complex. Essentially, a physical property is placed into a legal entity, like an LLC. The ownership of that LLC is then divided into digital tokens on a blockchain ledger. So when you buy a token, you are legally buying a share of the company that owns the deed.
Okay, but what if I own a digital token of an apartment building in Paris and the server hosting my token crashes or the crypto exchange goes bankrupt? Do I still own a piece of that Parisian building or does my investment just vanish into the ether?
That exact scenario highlights the massive regulatory gap currently plaguing digital assets.
I knew it.
While the blockchain ledger itself is decentralized and mathematically secure, the legal bridge connecting that digital token to the physical property deed is still incredibly fragile. In many jurisdictions, property law hasn't been updated since the 1800s. So if the platform goes bankrupt, enforcing your fractional ownership claim in a traditional court of law could be a decade-long nightmare. You are absolutely trading the traditional stability of real estate for unprecedented speed and liquidity, along with a massive dose of unresolved legal risk.
So we know where the capital is hiding. It's in bank vaults, private networks, crowdfunding platforms, and decentralized ledgers. But knowing where the money is doesn't mean anyone is going to actually give it to you.
No, it certainly doesn't.
That brings us to the actual mechanism of persuasion. Here's where it gets really interesting, because a pitch to an investor is essentially a psychological checklist you have to clear. You might be emotionally attached to the architectural style of a property, but the person holding the checkbook doesn't care about your passion.
Not even slightly. Capital is entirely unsentimental. Lenders and investors want cold, verifiable data that proves you understand how this asset functions in the real world. A successful pitch requires clearing five specific hurdles based on our source material.
Let's go through them.
The first is defining the fundamental nature of the asset.
Right, you have to declare your exact strategy. Like, are you buying a distressed commercial warehouse to flip in 6 months? Or are you buying a multifamily residential unit to hold for 20 years of passive income? The investor needs to know what game they are playing before they place a bet.
Exactly. And that leads to the second hurdle, which is location. It is a cliche for a reason, but you cannot just tell an investor a neighborhood is up and coming. You need to present hard data on local tenant demand, historical pricing trends, and specific economic drivers.
Stuff like, is a new hospital being built nearby, or are major employers moving into the area?
Yes, tangible data. And then we hit the third hurdle, which is where most amateur investors completely fall apart: costs and returns.
Ah, yes, the math. This is where the fantasy of real estate meets the reality of plumbing repairs.
It really is. You must provide a comprehensive financial breakdown. The purchase price, the closing costs, an aggressively realistic budget for renovations, ongoing property management fees, projected vacancy rates, and the ultimate exit strategy value.
You really have to map it all out.
You do.
Yeah.
Presenting this as a highly detailed spreadsheet is critical. A spreadsheet doesn't just show the numbers. It proves to the investor that you have done the rigorous, unglamorous work of stress testing the investment against worst-case scenarios.
Which flows right into the fourth step, the timeline. Capital hates uncertainty. An investor needs to know when the purchase will close, how many weeks the renovations will take, how long tenant onboarding historically takes in that specific zip code, and exactly when they will start seeing a return on their money.
And finally, the fifth step is the summary pitch. You must distill all of this complex data into a highly concise, factual presentation.
I love the term often used for a bad pitch, waffle.
Yes, waffling is a deal killer.
Think of it like being stuck in an elevator with a highly skeptical, highly impatient bank manager. You have 30 seconds. If you fill that time waffling about how beautiful the crown molding is going to look in the master bedroom, the elevator doors open, the manager walks out, and you get absolutely nothing. You have to focus entirely on the yield, the timeline, and the security of the asset.
And surprisingly, in that summary pitch, seasoned investors actually prefer you to project a modest, realistic return rather than a massive, inflated one.
Wait, really? Why wouldn't I want to promise a 25% return to make the deal sound irresistible?
Because seasoned investors understand the fundamental laws of risk and reward. Real estate inherently involves unexpected costs, a foundation issue, a permitting delay, a tenant default.
Things go wrong.
Always. If you present a business plan claiming a guaranteed 25% return with zero risk, a professional investor doesn't think you are a genius. They think you are either dangerously naive or you are running a scam. Honesty about the potential risks actually builds credibility.
It builds trust. And a perfect spreadsheet is absolutely useless without human trust. Which brings us to the fragile bridge between building a relationship and ensuring legal protection. Because a lot of capital raising starts close to home, right? Pitching to friends, family, and colleagues. But I have to ask, isn't this a Thanksgiving lawsuit waiting to happen? Every cautionary tale tells us that mixing family and money is just a disastrous idea.
It is an incredibly high-stakes environment, I'll give you that.
Yeah.
When you borrow from a bank and the deal goes south, you ruin your credit score. When you borrow from your family and the deal goes south, you ruin Christmas for the next decade.
Exactly.
The only way to mitigate that risk is through aggressive, formalized legal protection.
So a generic template downloaded off the internet isn't going to cut it. If I am doing a joint venture with my uncle, what are the actual tripwires we need to plan for?
A robust contract doesn't just dictate how you split the profits when things go perfectly. It must exhaustively detail the protocols for when things go wrong. Like, what is the legal mechanism if construction runs 30% over budget? Who is legally obligated to inject more cash? What happens if the property sits vacant for a year? What if one partner dies unexpectedly? A proper contract removes emotion from a crisis. It protects both the relationship and the capital by predetermining the response to failure.
And that level of legal clarity also extends to regulatory compliance, doesn't it? If you are raising significant capital, you aren't just dealing with your uncle anymore. You are dealing with the government.
Absolutely. Tax obligations and corporate structures vary wildly depending on your jurisdiction. If you pool money from multiple investors, you might inadvertently create an unregistered entity.
Which sounds bad.
It is. That triggers massive fines from financial regulators. You might be legally required to provide formal disclosures or operate under the oversight of a registered advisor.
Why is there such a massive emphasis on getting the compliance perfect right out of the gate? I mean, why not just ask for forgiveness later?
Because the world of capital investment is remarkably small. Reputations are built over decades and destroyed in an afternoon. If an investor knows you operate a legally sound, fully compliant operation, they are likely to invest with you again, even if a specific project hits a snag. In the long game of real estate, your integrity is a far more valuable asset than any single property in your portfolio.
Okay, to prove that these concepts of trust, technology, and alternative finance aren't just abstract theories, let's look at a concrete, real-world example from our deep dive materials. Let's examine the Saudi market, specifically a platform called Usul Gamma.
Usul Gamma is a fascinating case study in how regulatory support and technology can completely remove the traditional friction of property investment. It is an app that allows individuals to purchase fractionalized shares of fully vetted income-producing properties.
And the entry point is what completely blew my mind. You can buy into a property for as little as 500 SAR. So what does this all mean? It means the entire narrative of saving for a massive down payment is bypassed. You don't have to buy the entire bakery just to get a taste of the profits. You can literally buy a single, highly regulated slice of the pie from your smartphone.
But the technology only functions because it operates within a highly specific, deeply historical financial framework.
Right.
The Saudi market is governed by Sharia-compliant financing methods, which strictly prohibit the charging or paying of interest.
Which means a traditional Western mortgage, which is entirely based on renting money via interest rates, is fundamentally incompatible. So how does capital actually move?
Through incredibly sophisticated alternative structures. For example, Mirabaha, which is a cost-plus financing arrangement.
Cost-plus?
Yes. Instead of lending you money to buy a house and charging you interest, the bank actually buys the property outright. They hold the title, absorbing the ownership risk. They then immediately sell the property back to you at an agreed-upon profit markup, which you pay off in installments.
Okay, so you aren't paying interest on a loan. You're paying a fixed markup on a physical sale. The mechanism is entirely different.
Exactly. And then you have Mushiraka, which is a deeply traditional form of joint venture, where both profits and losses are shared proportionally between the bank and the investor.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that Sharia-compliant Mushiraka maps perfectly onto the core concept of equity we discussed at the very beginning of this deep dive.
It really does. It demonstrates how ancient, ethically rooted principles of shared risk and reward are seamlessly driving modern multi-million dollar real estate developments. And all of this is actively supported by government initiatives like Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030, which aims to improve global investor access.
Though, crucially, the system relies on rigorous compliance, right? With foreign investors requiring specific licenses under the strict oversight of the Real Estate General Authority.
Yes, the regulation is what makes it work safely.
The ultimate theme here is that whether you are signing a massive Mirabaha agreement with an institutional bank or buying a 500 Ryal fractional share on an app, strict regulatory adherence is the only thing keeping your capital safe. We have covered an immense amount of ground today.
We really have.
We dismantled the old myth that you need to be independently wealthy to invest. We explored the mechanics of debt versus equity, understanding the difference between renting a tool and marrying a business partner. We toured the global marketplace of capital, from traditional mortgages to peer-to-peer lending, and built a psychological blueprint for pitching that proves you are a reliable steward of someone else's money.
We've seen that the current economic climate isn't a dead end. It is merely an obstacle course. By understanding contracts, compliance, and the creative application of capital, the stability of real estate remains entirely accessible.
But there is one final lingering thought I want to leave you with. We talked heavily about the digitization of assets, you know, tokenized shares on a blockchain, and apps like Osul Gamma allowing you to buy micro fractions of a building for 500 SAR. If technology continues to slice physical property into smaller and smaller digital pieces, how is that going to fundamentally alter human psychology regarding ownership?
It forces us to ask what we actually value. I mean, when you can instantly own a microscopic liquid fraction of an apartment complex in Riyadh, a commercial warehouse in London, and a duplex in Tokyo right from your phone, does the emotional desire for physical property change?
Precisely. For generations, the ultimate symbol of security has been holding the physical keys to one specific front door. But if wealth generation becomes entirely decentralized and frictionless, will we abandon the white picket fence altogether? Will the next generation simply choose to become a swarm of global digital micro-landlords? It feels like the very definition of what it means to own property is evolving right under our feet. Something to think about.